Hey, welcome to Short Fine Legs, the cricket podcast that churns out episodes like Dean Elgar scores his runs. They don't come out very fast, and they're not always pretty, but man are they effective. And that's just one of the reasons why he deserves the test captaincy of the Proteas. Have I stretched that metaphor too far? Have I lost my areas? Well, yeah, maybe I have. My name is Daniel Gallen, I'm a freelance journo from Jozi, now residing in London, where lockdown is very different to Mzansi. But at least we can take solace in the fact that there are those with their hands on the levers of power who, like their counterparts in South Africa, abide by a different set of rules and are accountable to no one but themselves. We're in partnership this week, as always, with the absolute champions at Raider Media. Now, if the show is like the methodical accumulator, then the rest of the stable is a dream team of dashing stroke makers and aggressive fast bowlers. Is that metaphor stretched enough? Just go check them out. Today's chat is with a legend of South African domestic cricket and a man who didn't get nearly enough love in national colours. We spoke about his rise through the ranks, cementing his standing at the Titans, learning to cope with criticism, Colpack contracts, titles won, and of course that drop catch at the 2015 World Cup semi-final. It's Mr. Farhan Faji Behadin. So I'm speaking with a man who has represented South Africa in 59 ODIs, 38 T20Is, has cemented his status as an icon in the Republic with 114 first-class matches, 222 List A matches, and 175 domestic T20 matches. A man whose Twitter bio reads, "Pain heals, chick stick scars, glory lasts forever." It is my good pleasure to welcome to the show Farhan Behadin.
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, lekker, thanks. My first question is, do you mind if I call you Fudgy throughout this conversation? By the end of it, we'll be firm friends, I promise you.
Please call me Fudgy. I introduce myself as Fudgy on every occasion. It's just easier.
When did you get Fudgy? Is that a nickname that you've had your whole life?
1998, the rugby training at Westerford High School in down in Cape Town. We had an outside coach come in and he was reading names of a roster to see who was present at the practice. And he went through a list of names, Daniel, Mark, Alex, Tristan. He got to my name and he struggled to pronounce it. And he was kind of booming and eyeing. And then the first word that popped into his head that started with an F was Fudge. And he dubbed me Fudge. And since 1998, the next day at school, all my mates started calling me Fudge or Fudgy, and it's stuck ever since.
What did you think of it? Did you fight it at first? Or were you into it?
No, I didn't really care. I mean, I didn't know it was going to stick for so long. I thought, this guy just one day at training. But then, it's just stuck. He actually got a hold of me the other day. I commented on a post from a friend from Facebook, and he actually commented, he replies, because I haven't spoken to him since 1998, and he actually apologizes for not pronouncing my name, but, 22 years later, it's firmly stuck.
That's so funny. I've got a nickname, but I'm not going to tell you, and I fought it. I couldn't stand it when my friends first gave it to me, and there's nothing that cements a nickname like you fighting against it, so I'm glad you were cool with it.
Well, when I went to varsity, the varsity guys, just a little bit outside, Innocence was, it was an innocent nickname in high school. When I got to varsity, they started calling me Fudgebacker, so that didn't take too well.
I guess that is an inevitable next step, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I got to ask you, how's lockdown treating you? Besides accelerating your facial hair?
Yeah, no, lockdown has been okay. Fortunately, I'm a gamer, so it's actually been quite fine. I've finished quite a lot of games over the last three, four weeks. I can't train. I can't go to the gym. Can't obviously hit balls. That's a bit of a bummer. I can't run. South Africa's on a hard lockdown, so you're not allowed to leave your premises. So that is a bit tough. I can't open up the lungs and go for a run on the street. Or, but other than that, cooking, biking, gaming, I mean, all of the brine, that's, I mean, all of those things.
What have you baked? What's been the fudgy special?
I've done a pear sponge cake, or sponge cake, as my missy would suggest. And I've done a spinach and feta quiche. I've done top deck chunky biscuits or cookies. I've done a banana bread.
Yeah, the banana bread's a classic one. I've also done one of those.
Yeah, I mean, it's standard. I mean, I gave into the banana bread, like, a story, but...
Have you made a sourdough yet?
I haven't made a sourdough yet. I don't think I'm interested in a sourdough.
That is next level stuff. Once you make a sourdough, you are officially under lockdown. it's a marker.
I've been brine a lot, okay. I'll tell you that much.
Nice. Alright, cool, man. So, you recently hung up your boots and gloves for the Titans after an absolutely stellar career where you established yourself as a legend, having committed 14 years to the franchise. Can you just sum up what the organization means to you, any particular highlights you'd like to draw on? I mean, could you maybe encapsulate your life in Centurion over the last 14 years for the Titans?
Yes, how long is your podcast?
We got lots of time. We're all under lockdown. There's nowhere else to go.
Yeah, it's been pretty special. You know, I took a punt when I was a young kid, 22 years old, from Cape Town, moving up to the northern parts of the country, Pretoria, Blue Bull country, quite Afrikaans. I'm a city kid from Cape Town, very English. Used to the beach and the mountains, and it was quite an adjustment coming to Pretoria, or moving to Pretoria. But it means everything to me. It's given me every opportunity that I currently have and have had over the last 14 years playing for the Titans. It means so much to my playing career. It means a lot to my family. It means a lot to me. I've gotten to travel the world as a result of playing for the team, because the Titans is a stepping stone to playing for South Africa. I got to meet some really good friends, lifelong friends. I got to learn from the best in the business, playing the sport that I love. And then we were very successful as a team, as a franchise team. Since it became franchise cricket in South Africa, we've won 18 trophies, and I've been a part of 16 of them. So, I mean, that from a success point of view and a championship winning point of view, the 16 trophies is definitely a highlight. We went through very successful phases through the Titans' history, and I'm very proud to be a part of that.
If you could maybe single out one moment that just kind of maybe encapsulated the entire thing, one match, one innings, one bowling performance, one time where you were sitting in the dressing room looking at your teammates. I mean, it's maybe unfair to ask for you to pick one moment of a 14-year career, but what is the first one that comes to mind?
Well, I'll give you two that stands out really, thoroughly stands out. Well, three. The first one is in my second year when I was this young kid. I was on peanuts. I was earning so little cash, but I was doing what I loved, and that was all that matters 14 years ago. And in my second year, your first year, I was 14, I won a trophy in my first year, played most of the games, but in my second year, in a one-day cup final at SuperSport Park against the Warriors. Back then, we experimented with 45-over cricket, and it was a 45-over final, and I was batting with Albie Morkel, and I wasn't a bad performer. I was just young. I was kind of learning my trade, learning the skill set, learning what it means to play tough cricket, and from Martin van Jaarsveld, Pierre Joubert, and Paul Harris, Dale Steyn, Albie Morkel, Alfonso Thomas. Those are the guys that I grew up playing with, and then in that second year, in a final, we were 210 after about 40 overs. We had about 5 overs left. I was batting on the other end with Albie Morkel. And Albie Morkel, and I was like, look, Albie, I'll just get one, and then you can obviously take it on. And he actually gave me the confidence. He said something to me that was really you're found at that moment, he's like, you have the ability to clear the ropes and you have the ability to take these bowlers down. And he gave me that confidence. And we ended up getting 275 at the end of the 45th over. So we ended up scoring about 65 runs in like five overs. I ended on 59 not out of 30 balls. And their bowling attack was Johan Botha, who played for South Africa, Rashid Tehran, who played for South Africa, and Wabito Tsobe. They had quite a stellar Zander de Bruyne, who played for South Africa. So that was the first time that gave me the confidence to kind of like, I cemented my place a little bit. I showed them what they... I've kind of repaid the faith of the Titans giving me a contract, and that kind of, that moment stands out very early on.
And getting getting that endorsement from a guy like LB Morkel, who, as you say, is renowned for clearing the ropes, for him to tell you in the middle that you can do that. I mean, you know, nothing instills confidence like having a person who's so good at what they do telling you that you can also do it.
Yeah, that affirmation was immense, and it kind of... Throughout my whole career, if there was one person, I'm kind of watching the documentary, The Last Dance with Michael Jordan, that's on Netflix at the moment, and he says he wasn't half the player that he is without Scottie Pippen. And I felt throughout my career growing up, I'm not half the player that I am because of Albie Morkel, because he was always batting just below me or just ahead of me, and we always batted in the crunch times, and I learned so much from him. But that one particular moment in my second year gave me that confidence. One other moment that stands out is when we won three T20 titles in a row. And then in the final, I mean, we just had the team. I mean, our team was a bomb side. Quinton de Kock, Aidan Markram. You had AB de Villiers. You had myself, Albie Morkel, Chris Morris, David Visser, Shamsi, Lunking, Giri, Junior Dala, like all international players. And we knew when we rocked to the ground that we had this. And... Those two moments stand out, like, from what I remember.
You know, a lot of people talk about, like, I once asked Gavin Hunt, the football manager, what it means to, like, you know, what's the secret to being a good coach? And he said just having good players, because it's not just that good players play well, it's that good players are kind of like these electrons or like these atoms that kind of buzz amongst each other, that just being next to greatness makes you play so much better. Being part of a team like that, I mean, did you feel like unbeatable at times? Did you feel like no matter what happens, one of these guys, one of us, is going to pull us out?
100%. A few years back when we won those three titles, Bacha came on board. So we went through a bit of a lean period. So about 5 years ago. We only won one trophy out of 2 years, and that. But we were in a building phase, and at the end of that three-year cycle, the third year, we ended up winning two trophies, and there was a kind of a period where we started looking at the culture of our team and how we can rebuild that. But by then, the players weren't as strong, they weren't as experienced, they didn't get enough match or game time at the highest level, well, the provincial level or the franchise level, to kind of put in solid performances week in and week out. And I think after that period where we were lean, we went to a period where we were very strong, and you can rely on those players. We had Quinton de Kock moving from the Lions to the Titans. We had Chris Morris coming from the Lions to the Titans. We had Debray Shamsi, who is now the national ODI spinner. He actually moved from the Dolphins to us as quite a shrewd buy, Junior Dala. I mean, the emergence of Aidan Markram, I mean, the list goes on. I mean, myself, I was an old horse. AB was an old horse. Dale Steyn, Albie Morkel, David Visser. I mean, I'm naming all international players. I mean, yeah. Our team was immensely strong over most of my career. The last year or two, it's been a bit of another rebuilding phase, and no doubt in a couple of years' time, we'll be pushing for honours again, strongly.
But you're not quite done playing yet, are you? You've signed a cold pack contract to go play for Durham in the north of England. You do know it's freezing up there, right?
I do know it's freezing. look, it was always my dream to kind of finish off my career in the UK. It's always had such history and such a love for the game in the UK that I wanted to be a part of that. I've been over to the UK on many occasions. I've played club cricket on 5 different occasions for 5 different teams all over the UK in the northeast. I have played in the northeast before. I've played in the northwest in the Lancashire leagues, and I've toured with the national side. So I've been very fortunate to experience cricket there, and I've always wanted to play in the UK and play for the club, in any club. I mean, I would have been happy to have played for any club. Unfortunately, Durham came knocking with quite a rich heritage of cricket and some awesome players. So, yeah, that is kind of fulfilling one of my goals I set out when I was a young boy. So, yeah.
Do you know what's going to happen now with this lockdown? I mean, we spoke off the record, well, before we started recording, rather, that the Durham players have been furloughed. There's talk that the entire season may be scrapped. What was the nature of your contract? I mean, was it a single-year contract? Do you know that if you'll be playing next year, if this season is scrapped? I mean, do you know what the future, you know, what's going to happen?
Well, I've signed a 2-year deal with the option for the third.
Okay.
So I know Gold Pack is a contentious issue in the UK, and they're looking to scrap it at the end of the season. And by doing that, they might increase the amount of overseas players for the next season. Although a lot of things are up in the air. I mean, I think the Gold Pack discussion is again up for discussion because this season has been so badly affected by something that is out of everybody's control, and I'm not sure exactly how they're going to tackle that Gold Pack decision. But yeah, I mean,
have you been in touch with Durham while this has been going on?
Yeah, quite often with the director of cricket, Marcus North, and the coach, James Franklin, and they've indicated if the Gold Pack falls away, they're looking to just change the details of my contract to the second overseas.
Right, okay. So I guess that gives you some security. And I want to talk about Gold Packs. And as you said, obviously Gold Packs are not just a sensitive issue in England. They're an extremely sensitive issue in South Africa for South African fans. Yeah, as someone who committed so much of your life to domestic cricket in South Africa at the peak of your powers, and I'm sure there could have been stages where you decided, you know what, I'm not making the national side regularly, I can just go play Gold Pack and earn more money, earning pounds. I mean, what was your thoughts on Gold Pack, say, 5 years ago?
I actually got offered a few deals about 3 years ago. Mm. So 2016, actually. And not 2017, and that back then I was still playing in the national side, and the thing is, you got to do the calculations and do the numbers, and playing for the national side and playing a bit in South Africa and going to ICC events. If you were to do the books, you know, from a financial point of view, you actually earn more money staying and not taking a callback deal. Depending on your callback deal, I mean, some players could obviously get paid more than others, but based on an average callback deal, kind of worked it out with some rough numbers. That was my consideration, and I obviously love playing for South Africa. Mm-hmm. I love playing for South Africa. It was a boyhood dream watching Jonty Rhodes grow up and Ansi and Big Mac, Sean Pollock and Jacques Callis and Gibbs. So whoever made that decision back in the day, I had no issues with it. They were free to make their own choices. And mainly it comes around about just hanging around, being a fringe player in the national side. That is why the guys choose Gold Pack. It's the certainty of playing. Everybody wants to play and win trophies and win games and to not play and to be on the edge, on the fringes of a national team and tour the whole time and watch your years go by is a tough thing.
But, you know, a lot of the criticism around Gold Packs is that, yes, okay, maybe we don't lose the likes of AB de Villiers and Dale Steyn, for example, to Gold Packs, but losing guys like Dwan Olivier and Simon Harmer doesn't necessarily weaken the protest side. You can argue that case or not, but it certainly weakens South African domestic cricket. You know, all that intellect, yes. that IP is lost. You know, the ability to nurture youngsters is lost. As a guy who started as a youngster, progressed and became a senior, as you describe yourself, an old horse, Was there ever a part where you looked around and be like, yes, we could really do with some more seasoned guys in our domestic game?
I definitely think that there's a case for more seasoned guys. I think it takes a while for the current group of guys to get up to some sort of senior level. Not a lot of guys have played 150 games plus per format, or, you know, 100 first-class games, List A games are very far and few between. Some of my best friends have played for years and they've only played like 60 games, List A games, you know. Like, from an experience point of view, it's not a hell of a lot. So yes, we do need more experienced players, and unfortunately CSA has decided not to fund the callback players if you were to have them in the system. And that's a decision that they took a couple of years back to kind of, once you take your callback deal, you can't basically have your bread buttered on both sides. So have your callback contract and then come back to South Africa and then play for the Titans or the Warriors or the Cobras, for instance. So they kind of closed the door on having those senior players, unfortunately. I saw Graham Smith is willing to welcome the callback players back. I don't know in what capacity.
Just staying on that, I mean, did you, maybe animosity is a bit of a tough word, but did you ever feel sort of a negativity towards the guys who left, who didn't want to stay and kind of help out? I mean, like, you guys are the Titans, you were chock full of senior players, but you look at some of the smaller franchises, maybe the Warriors or the Knights.
They
could have really used with more senior players, and that would have only have made the domestic game a lot stronger. Was there ever a case that, like, you felt like you were on the front lines fighting the good fights and other guys had just ducked and weren't willing to put in the work?
No, that was their decision to make.
Okay.
I had no issues with them. I'm friends with Armour, I'm friends with Duane Olafide. I was friends with Dane Villas, all the guys that decided at the time to go over. It was probably the right time for them to go over.
Right.
Yes, look, South African market can't compete with the rand. So financially, for those guys that weren't playing international cricket, going to the UK, they would be earning more money, first of all. And second of all, there's so much more cricket to be played in the UK. So then you get your stats up. You give an opportunity to perform in front of crowds in four-day cricket, Vitality Blast, you get one-day cricket. There's an opportunity to build a different career, build a different legacy. I think here in South Africa, there's only 30 games, over 10 first-class games, 10 50-over games, 10 T20 games. And then there's, there is a quota system in place.
Yeah.
Not all of them are always guaranteed. Duane Olafide, as much as you think he's a great bowler, he has very little T20 and 50 over stats. He plays that format. Simon Armour, the same thing. Just last year, he was T20 player of the year in the UK. Single-handedly won them a semi and won a final for them. And I don't think he would have had that opportunity in South Africa, unfortunately. So as much as it is a financial thing and... So we need the experience. I firmly believe that we definitely need the experience. It's a little bit unfortunate, but there's no ill feelings towards those guys. They make their bed, they line it, and we all kind of just crack on with it, really. I think the top brass is more aggrieved by their decisions, to be honest.
No, that's interesting. So let's now go back to the beginning. According to your Crick Info page, you were born in Johannesburg, but you grew up in the Western in Cape Town. Is that correct? Where in Joburg were you born?
I was born, I was actually writing a memoir. I have started writing a memoir, really. I'm not too sure where I was born.
When did you move down to Cape Town?
Yeah. Well, I was born in Joburg. I grew up in a place called... Well, I grew up in Hillbrow for the first bit of my... Back then, when Hillbrow was still decent, and stayed in Bosman till 5 years old, and then moved down to Cape Town when I was five. Lived there for 17 years till 22, and then moved to Pretoria. And I've been in Pretoria for 14 years. That's kind of the cycle.
So you consider yourself a Cape Town kid, though?
Yeah, when everybody asks me where you're from, I always say I'm from Cape Town, but I now currently reside in Pretoria.
Right.
So I'll always be a Cape Townian, and I'll always be from Cape Town. So I grew up, went to school, and I currently live in Pretoria.
When did the bug bite? When did the cricket bug bite? I mean, I remember watching Australia against South Africa at an ODI in, God, I want to say 95 or 96 at the Wanderers, and I just thought this was the coolest thing in the world. I was running around eating those little mini donuts, and I was just like, I just want to live at a cricket ground. When was it for you?
92 World Cup, Jonty Rhodes ran out in Zimamulak.
Right.
That's the one moment I thought that's what I want to do one day.
Yeah.
Basically that moment just changed my whole, I thought that was the coolest thing I've seen. It was on TV. I knew I wanted to play sport on TV because not too long after that, I went to Newlands and the Aussies were touring. Yeah, I think in 94, Steve Waugh, I got an autograph, photograph of Steve Waugh, and I thought that was my most prized position.
Hmm.
Yeah, it was around, so 92, I was, 9 years old, and I just thought, oh man, that was the coolest thing. Jonty Rhodes ran out I've ever seen, and that kind of got me hooked from there on.
It's amazing how one play can change your relationship with the sport. I mean, you didn't mention the results. You didn't even mention the tournament. It was that one play that Jonty Rhodes picks the ball up and dives and runs Inzimam Al-Haq out. As a professional player now, you've played for South Africa. Do you ever think at the back of your mind, like, I could do something that, like, changes a kid's life? Like, is that ever something that you think about?
I don't know. I don't think about it that way. I kind of just think I could do something really special that I'll remember forever, or I can do something really special to win the game for my team from absolutely nowhere. I think that those types of memories sticks in rather than doing it that some kid's going to remember. Mm. I do it because I wanted to do it, because whenever the chips are down, or when there's nothing, no more a slither of a chance to win or to kind of come out on top, that's the moment that I kind of think about. Like, if nothing else is on, maybe I can do something special here.
Mm. So you begin your professional career down in Cape Town, as you said, in 2004. Your first-class debut is against Eastern Province, where you share the new ball with Craig Alexander in a side that also includes Paul Adams. Now, was your captain up to something, or did you have some serious wheels back then?
No, I was a bowler. So in high school, I opened a bowling in high school, and I batted four when I opened the bowling. When I went to varsity, I went to UCT, and my opening bowling partner was Ryan Tendeskarte.
Oh, wow.
And we won everything that he has, a club side, the UCT cricket side. We had an unbelievable side. We won the two-day league in Cape Town, the knockout league in Cape Town. We won varsity week in Pretoria, and then we won club champs as well. So we were the best club in the country in 2002-2003 season. And I learned my cricket from Ryan Tendeskarte. Similar players. But back then, I could crank it up to about 130. So I was like, who bowls 130? Probably like Andile, maybe a little bit quicker than Andile, Pehla Kwayo. Mm. But I was very skilled. I opened the bowling for the B side, but also I was young, so my back could handle it.
Right.
And then, I was an opening bowler back in the day.
You also scored 60, batting at number 8 in your side's first innings. I mean, for me, that's quite indicative of your career, because, I mean, if I had to look at that and say, okay, this guy opened the bowling, he does all right, numbers are okay, he scores 60, batting at number 8. I mean, I would have no idea how to pin you down as a cricketer. But, I mean, I guess when people look back at your career, it is quite hard to pin you down as a cricketer. I mean, you're perhaps one of the most polarizing figures in modern Proteas history. I mean, what kind of cricketer are you?
I would say I'm a fighter. I've never been the prettiest of players. I'm a fighter, and I've evolved into a batsman. I would say over the last 2 years, but I was a bowling all-rounder that evolved into a batting all-rounder because the Titans bowling unit was always strong. That Paul Harris, Dale Steyn, Morne Morkel, Etienne Balati, Alfonso Thomas, Albie Morkel. And then for the majority of my years, we played with two all-rounders in white ball cricket, David Visser and Albie Morkel as your all-rounders batting at 6 and 7. That's besides three fast bowlers and a spinner. Mm. And Henry Davis is batting up in the top order. That's before Adam Markham came. So that's two off-spinners, who more than capable off-spinners. And then that's if Dean Alger plays, there's your other left-arm orthodox. So you had, and then I was the odd one out, you know. So I never bowled. I evolved into a batting all-rounder. It's funnily enough, I bowled more for South Africa than I'd ever bowled for the Titans.
Yeah, yeah. Do you wish you bowled more?
For South Africa, for the Titans?
No, well, both, just in your career. I mean, as you said, you started as a bowler. Do you wish that you were as remembered for your bowling as your batting?
I always thought I could do a job, but I think early on I was just very evident that I wasn't going to bowl too much. So instead of working on my skill set like 50-50, 50%, 50%, I geared towards batting. I staggered the batting work ethic a lot more because I knew me bowling 120, even if I really cranked it up in my old age, getting up to 125 kilometers per hour was basically not going to do anything. So I basically stacked my training and everything. I'd stacked it against the bowling. I'd kind of worked so hard on my batting and my fielding and my batting and learning that craft more so. But I would say, if you ask me what type of cricket I am, I would say I'm a fighter. You know, chips are down. I try and get the team to a respectable score or try and chase a score down. A team man. I mean, you ask me what type of player I'm a... I consider myself quite a team man, whatever the team needs, and I've never been selfish in that regard.
Mm. It's interesting you talk about how there came a stage in your career where you had to focus on your batting rather than your bowling. I just wonder, as a senior player who's played 14 years at the top, have you seen talented youngsters not make that decision or make the decision too late where if only they had focused more on their batting and given up their bowling, or if only they had stop trying to be the first team wicketkeeper and just focus on their batting or something like that. I mean, is that something that is actually quite difficult for youngsters to make, that decision?
The thing is, if you were to ask me what advice would I give, my advice is to try and do everything, to try and be 3-in-1 cricketers, to try and offer some spin or some medium pace, or to try and be a spare wicketkeeper, or, you know, I think that's where the game is kind of geared to. Yes, you do have your specialist bowlers, your specialist batters, but if you have the capabilities to do a few of the disciplines, then try to. But there is definitely a time where, like, one of my really good friends, Arno Kun, he was one of the best wicketkeeper batters in the country. He averaged 45 in first-class cricket, and he was one of the best, most athletic wicketkeepers in our country. Unfortunately, the guy ahead of him was Mark Boucher, and Boucher wasn't going to be dropped. So after a while, he just decided, well, look, his back's not going to handle it for too much longer. He's going to just decide to become a batsman. And we all hated that decision for him because Boucher had his injury with his eye, and Heineke gave up the keeping. And I mean, we were all just so upset for him. We were just like bleak for him because we knew that he had the capabilities to play. And you know what? Actually, fortunately, he actually got his opportunity to play test match cricket as a batsman. So that decision kind of worked out for him, even though we all thought that it was a poor one. So, right. I mean, that all depends what you make of your decision. If you can kind of push through and be masterful in your discipline, whether it be bowling, batting, or spin or whatever. So
yeah,
that's kind of my thought, you know.
Yeah, so by the time we get to around 2006-2007, you're pretty settled in that Titans side. I mean, alongside Martin van Jaarsveld.
No. And he started in 2006 and 2007.
I beg your pardon. 2006-2007 is your breakout year, though. Alongside Martin van Jaarsveld and Heino Kun, you play all 10 SuperSport Series matches.
Yes.
You average 32 with the bats in a winning campaign. You play a full quota of MTN 50 over comps. Likewise in the T20 format where you reach the semi-finals. I love how you're saying, yeah, yeah, like, it's all like, it's just, you just know your stats. I love a cricketer who knows their history.
in that year, we won 8 out of 10 games. We're only the second side. There's only one team that's won 8 first-class games out of 10 ever in the history of South African cricket, and that's the meme machine, the Transvaal meme machine. And we're the team that's won 8 out of, that year, we won 8 out of 10 games, which is one of the best introductions to cricket that I've ever had, which is pretty special.
And as you said, you played all 10 matches in that series. I mean, what an introduction to walk into a side and become a team akin to the Mean Machine. I mean, did you think that, hey man, you know what, this is it? Give me 2-3 years, I'm gonna be in the Proteas.
Yeah, look, I had a very disillusioned view of my playing when I started my professional career in Cape Town, when I played for the second team, Western Province. No, I've never played a first team game for the Cobras. So I thought I was going to play 1 year for the second team, then I was going, the next year I was going to play for the Western Province or for the Cobras at the time, and then in 3 years' time, from 18, I was going to be a national player. I had such a disillusioned view of what it would take. Mm. And yeah, look, even when I started the Titans, I knew I had such hard work, because that team was so settled. The national team was quite settled, and Jacques Callis and Achim Amla, and you had AB de Villiers kind of breaking the mold. And I knew there was a hard work ahead of me if I wanted to play for the national side. But that first year was a pretty cool start, though.
Mm. You say you were disillusioned, though. Do you think that prevented you from doing something that you perhaps should have, working hard at a particular aspect of your game? I mean, disillusionments can often lead to ill judgments when it comes to strategy.
Yeah, no, look, but that's when I was in Cape Town. I think I had kind of an epiphany, which is probably one of the worst moments of my life. I tore my ACL playing rugby. In the winter of 2005, because I was playing rugby and cricket at school, and I love rugby. And just before the start of that summer in 2005, I thought, look, I'll play half a rugby season, get my fitness up, get rough, get tough. Stop about 2 months before the cricket season, get fit, get cricket fit, do my skill work, you know, give it a real crack. You know, tore my ACL, and That kind of gave me the drive and the passion. And that kind of, so 3 years after school, I was like, okay, cool. I was cruising along. And then I hurt my knee, and then I moved to Pretoria. And then I actually realized, well done, this is going to take a lot longer than just a couple of years before I, you know, establish myself as a regular performer and a winner, championship winner, maybe play for South Africa. So that's kind of the what it took. And an injury kind of gave me that perspective.
Your career coincided at this stage with a golden generation of players. I mean, in South Africa, at the top of the order, Graham Smith, Hashim Amla, AB de Villiers, Jacques Callis was still knocking around. Fuff was coming through. JP was doing his thing. Wayne Parnell and Johan Boerter added to the roster of all-rounders at the 2011 World Cup. I mean, was there ever a point where you doubted it would happen for you?
No, never. No. So what happened before Faf du Plessis made his debut in 2000, and in the summer of 2011, the beginning, so the year before Colin Ingram made his debut for South Africa in ODI cricket, in the 50-over competitions preceding his selection, he batted 3 for the Warriors, got 500-plus runs in that domestic comp, got selected for South Africa. The year after that, Faf du Plessis did exactly the same thing. Scored 500-plus runs, batting at 3 for the Titans, got selected for South Africa. And I was like, okay, what should I do here? I've been playing for about 4 years, maybe. I've been playing for about 5 years, or 4 years at the time, and I thought, should I ask the coach, do I need to bat at number 3 and score 500-plus runs in a domestic comp before getting selected for South Africa? I decided on a different route. I decided on, look, I've never batted in the top 3 in my life. I've always been 5-6. If I can be the best finisher in the country, that might be an opportunity for me to play for South Africa. And that's what I focused on. And I knew I had Justin Antlong was in my position, Ryan Bailey at the time, David Miller at the time. well, still currently, and John Sams with the Lions. Those are the guys that I was competing with, and I took it upon myself, and yeah, I suppose I got there in the end. It took me 6 years.
So it's interesting that your path to the Proteus side was paved with a different strategy, where rather than being, okay, I'm going to be number 3-4, I'm going to score over the 500 runs and be the premier batter in the side, I'm going to be the guy who finishes. I mean, it's perhaps such an underrated skill. I mean, I grew up watching Michael Bevan, and I couldn't understand what this guy was doing. How was he so good at finishing? And you look at the Proteus now, and it's like, well, could really do with a player. Like, I mean, what is the secret of being a good finisher? You know, what is the mindset that is required to be, okay, I'm not going to be the guy at number 4. I'm going to be the guy at number 6. I might not score as many runs, but I'm going to win more matches.
You have to have a tough skin, first of all.
Right.
That position comes with a lot of criticism, yeah. a lot of hardship.
A lot of misunderstanding, I think, from the public as well. People don't really understand that position, do they?
Yeah, it's tough. They see you not, I mean, sometimes you have to go at a strike rate of, well, run. You have to chase a game. Right, you started at 7s and gets up to 9, 10 quickly, and they can't imagine why you're not taking on a boundary option, and they're thinking, you know, why you're not taking a risk now, or why are you waiting so long, and then if you get out caught in 20 or 20, you basically lost the game for the team, and such a, I mean, my first comment about it was to have a tough skin or thick skin, because you know when you haven't done well, you know when you haven't taken the right option, you know you should have maybe hit a single or try and push more twos today instead of trying to hit six sixes in the over type thing. So it's just so tough. There's so many nuances, there's so many little idiosyncrasies, there's so many little things about chasing or sitting a score, batting at the back end, the pitch, the bowlers, the quality of the bowlers, the quality of the umpiring, how big the field is it quick paced, is the ball reversing now, is it tailing just a little bit, is the cutter gripping a bit more, is the bowler using his bounces a bit more? You got to think about so many different things.
Yeah, I imagine that the most important thing is that you have to want to do it. You have to be the guy who says,
yes,
get me on strike, I'm going to do this. I mean, what a terrifying prospect that must be at times.
Yeah, that is, you got that mindset. Sorry, you asked about the mindset, and you got a thick skin, but the mindset is you have to get up and go again, because probably you're not going to succeed a couple of games in a row. But then at one time you do succeed in whatever chasing or setting, like, take confidence from that. You hold on to all of the good things, and as soon as you make an error, you kind of, you kind of just spin it, you let it go, you hold on to all of the good things, but the mindset has to be a strong one. You have to want to do it, you have to be fit to do it at the back end, because you can't be fatigued, you have to, I mean, sorry, my neighbor was just shouting across the thing there.
That's all right.
Yeah, you're going to have to want to do it, and that's basically the bottom line. If you don't want to do it, then you get out of the kitchen, really.
Yeah. So 2011, 2012, you have that year that gets you on the radar. You average 45 in the 50-over competition and 66 in the T20 competition. And you're recognized as South Africa's T20 Player of the Year. What clicked that season? I mean, what are your memories of that campaign?
So we had a new coach, Matthew Maynard, at the time. We went through quite a lean spell just before. So 2 years with Richard Pybus, unbelievable. 2 years with Chris van Noordwijk. And then in the fifth year, which was the 2011-2012 season, Matthew Maynard came. And he came with a different philosophy in the UK about trust yourself and that he backs you. And he's played 400 first-class games for in the UK, and he's played 400 List A games. So he comes with a wealth of experience. So he spoke with a calmness. And he kind of gave me the confidence to go out and express myself the way that I wanted to. And that was, I just went through a purple patch. You know, sometimes you go through a comp where you just everything clicks and In the final, I got about 46 of about 26 balls not out, and we got to a score of 180 at the Wanderers at the boarding, and I played it perfectly. I studied the game really well. My 4 years preceding that particular year was awesome apprenticeship, and I studied the bowling well that particular competition, and I was on top of it that year.
Yeah, and you so that earns you your national call up, a T20 against India at the Wanderers on the 30th of March 2012. Let's just back up slightly. I mean, what was it like being involved in the Proteus camp in the lead up to that? And you know, what did you ever doubt that you belonged? I mean, many of us in any field, you know, from time to time feel imposter syndrome, that we're out of our depth. And I've spoken to many athletes who have spoken about this, that, you know, that you get that little doubt in your mind, like, am I good enough, until you actually do step onto the field. Did you ever feel that, or did you feel comfortable from the get-go?
No, I think, so the coach at the time is Gary Kirsten, and one of the best coaches I've ever played under. So, I think that particular year when I batted really well in the comps and the white ball stuff, I had the confidence. I was playing against players that were of good quality. You know, Chris Morris was playing for the Lions, the young Chris Morris, Sohail Tanveer was playing for the Lions. We had Imran Tahir playing for the Dolphins. Carl Abbott was playing. Johan van der Vaart was playing for the Ryan McLaren was playing for the Knights. Nicky Boyer, the Cobras. It was Rory Kleinfeld, Vernon Philander, Justin Kemp. I mean, Charles Langeveld was still in the setup. So, me coming through that season, player of the year in a 10-T20 comp, gave me that confidence. Mm. Going up to the next level was everybody's question is, can I crack it at this level? Made my debut that night. Jacques Callis, one of my absolute batting heroes, idols when I was growing up. I always wanted to be Jacques Callis instead of Herschel Gibbs, because he was everything correct and pure. And I thought I was going to bat 6 and 7. And Gary said to me, the team meeting the night before, you're batting at 4 tomorrow. And I thought, I don't even bat 4 for the Titans, but he wanted me to bat at 4 for the national side.
Wow.
We lose an early wicket, and Jacques Callis, I'm next in. We lose a wicket inside the first over, or the second over. And I thought, oh no, if I go, we're playing against India, it's a full Indian side as well. Dhoni, Suresh Raina, Irfan Pathan, it was a bomb Indian side. And I'm batting, and I'm very comfortable from overs outside of the power play. I never really batted inside the power play. And Jacques Callis and Carl Ingram, I think at the time, they had a massive partnership. And I only got in an over 15. And Jacques Callis, my hero, got out, and he was walking off, and I was walking onto the field. So we kind of crossed paths, and he kind of stopped, and he said to me, Fudgy, the wicket's good. Go get some runs for us. And that gave me so much goosebumps. The guy that I idolized for years as a kid growing up was the guy walking off giving me advice to go score runs for us. And us, I mean the Proteas, I mean our country. And that was one of the more special moments in my cricketing career. A guy of that stature and that nature, one of the best players that ever played the game, giving me advice, this young kid making his debut. I mean, that was a pretty special moment.
Yeah. Your second game for South Africa is at the T20 World Cup in Sri Lanka, which could have gone better. You guys are knocked out in the second round, having failed to win your 3 matches at that stage. But you played 9 T20s before your ODI debut. Were you worried at any stage that you were maybe being pigeonholed as a T20 specialist?
No, not at all. That was just a pathway that I was going to get picked. I mean, my breakout year was, my breakout format was T20. Gave me the confidence, just gave me the platform to play for South Africa. And I wasn't concerned at all. I think one day cricket's a bit more challenging. There's so many different scenarios. T20, it's shorter. I kind of knew my game at that time. I knew what was required, but then, you know, stepping up a level just changes the ball game, because the quality of the bowlers are much better. So, but I wasn't concerned about being pigeonholed. Well, certainly not then. As I got on in my career, I'm sure you'll get to that. I felt a bit pigeonholed.
Yes, yes, we will. And one of the things, which is a bit of a double-edged sword, you've touched on it though, because in 2013, you dig the side out of a hole with a gutsy 58 in an ODI against Pakistan and Centurion.
Yes, you guys
You guys lose the game on Duckworth Lewis, but you solidify your reputation as a man for a tough situation. And as you said, you're a fighter. But I've spoken to players who have been labelled as gritty and combative and gutsy. And these are, of course, positive words. But they can also be shorthand phrases for guys who maybe lack flair or skill. Or, you know, people talk about Dean Elgar in that way. People maybe even talk about, you know, Alistair Cook, Sir Alistair Cook, a giant of the game in that way. But it also comes with a touch of negativity. I mean, do you perceive these attributes that you speak about as a bit double-edged?
No, from my point of view, I welcome them.
Okay.
I think sports in general isn't all about the flash and all about the way that it's done. I think it's a lot goes on behind the scenes, whether it's the gym work, the rehab work, if you've been injured, the amount of preparation, the way you prepare. You know, you can be gutsy, you can be gritty in that, you can test yourself. And then the way it comes out, I mean, the whole point about our game is specifically cricket and specifically batting, is that no matter how you get there, if you get there, it'll be lauded and applauded. Mm. That's it. Mm. And that was my, I don't care how I get there. I can have a dirty bottom and squeeze once the mid-wicket all day. I don't care. I can edge a few fours, you know, like that pass the keeper. It doesn't matter how I do it. As long as I'm there and I can kind of fight that mental battle to get over the line, like, that's all that matters to me.
Yeah, I remember an innings once. One of my favorite innings of all time was Rulla Fundamerva against Australia, where he was trying to hoik Brett Lee over mid-wicket, but he kept top-edging it for six over third man. And
I think it might have been his debut, to be honest.
Was that his debut? Yeah, do you remember that innings? I mean, he must have done it like three or four times. It was the most incredible knock I've ever seen.
No, we still take the piss. We still pull the piss about that. Is the party's batting all the time.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, maybe you guys will share fields in England once normality resumes. But I want to talk about something a bit negative, unfortunately. One of the things you will be remembered for is being involved in that drop catch of Grant Elliott in the 2015 World Cup semi-final. But before we get onto that, what was the mood in the camp leading up to that game against New Zealand? There was a lot of noise around the selection of Vernon Philander over Carl Abbott and rumours of discontent from the skipper, AB. Were you guys in a good space leading up to that game?
The team was in a great space. I think we thought we could get New Zealand. If we can get to the final, there's nobody else out of... Because who did Australia play in the semis? Pakistan?
Oh, that is a good question.
I'm not sure who they played. I think they played Pakistan, if I'm not mistaken. And I think they were top, I think they won, so they were really through to the final. And then we played New Zealand. So I think because we believe that if we got to the final, we were the only team that could beat them because we had...
they played India. Sorry to interrupt. They played India.
India. Okay, they played India. But I think they beat India already. And then we just had this feeling that if we got to the final ahead of New Zealand... We had more firepower. We had Dale Steyn, Morne Morkel. We just had AB de Villiers, who basically cleaned up the whole of the World Cup that particular year. We had Hashim Amla. We had Quinton de Kock. We had people that could actually hurt Australia.
Right.
So we were pretty confident, and we had a great quarterfinal against Sri Lanka in Sydney, and we thought, oh man, this is going to be on. As that game unfolded, and then the night before, like, there was obviously very public knowledge as to what happened with regards to Vernon and Carl, and that kind of just unsettled the team a little bit. But I don't think it affected our performance that day because we batted really well and we were probably on target for about 350 plus. And the rain intervened, we got to the score that we got to, and things unfolded, and I was so keen to get onto the field, and Vernon Philander was he was physically fit but not match fit, and he got through his overs. I think he bowled his overs for about I'm not too certain, 6 runs and over or 6.5. And I was so keen to kind of make a difference. And I was like, get Vernon off and I'll go field. Like, I'll try and make a difference.
Yeah.
And that unfortunate incident happened. I kind of blocked it out of my mind because the ball was going 10 meters to my right. And there was only one person under the ball, and JP ran from fine leg. And the fine leg, a normal fine leg, it was too far, but because of the rugby field nature of the cricket field, means that fine leg was actually fairly closer than a normal cricket field, than the oval shape or the round shape.
Right.
And it was so loud at Eden Park that night, but I caught a glimpse of him in out of the corner of my eye. The split second, I had to keep my eye on the ball, and the rest, and he crashed into me, yeah. and that was it.
I mean, you know, let's talk about the catch, because, you know, two players colliding under a high ball is as old as cricket. You know, people have been doing it since we invented this game, and it really is just one of those things that happen. But because you guys are so good at what you do, I mean, you're professional athletes, the public tends to assume that you're somehow infallible superhumans, incapable of mistakes. I mean, you speak about the dimensions of the field, but I mean, what's it like when you forget a player running into you? Just standing under a high ball in a high pressure match with thousands of people watching, and, you know, millions of people are watching around the ground. I mean, what's that like? I mean, that must be quite nerve wracking without someone running towards you.
Yeah, so I mean, I'll take you through that whole scenario. Is that we were doing catches the day before on that exact same spot on the field. So we were, but at night time, from the dimensions of the stadium, right? So it's a rugby stadium, not with big pylons. They are very low lane lights. So once the ball went up in the air, it goes up past the stadium light. So it goes, you see it, and then you don't see it. And then the ball comes through the lights, and then you see it again. Yeah. Second of all, it's the loudest game ever, or the loudest sporting event at Eden Park ever, even bigger than Springboks versus All Blacks.
Yeah.
All the people we've ever spoken to have said that's loud. It's the loudest Eden Park has ever been. So there was no communication with regards to my ball or Fudgy's ball or JP's ball. Thirdly, it was a big thing in our whole chat leading up to the fielding part of our day, is that you have to want the ball. You have to be the person that wants it. So you don't shy away from the pressure. You actually you embrace the pressure and try and do something special for your team. And that is JP's mindset. And that's why, in a normal scenario, he leaves it to me, trusts me, and to make the catch or not make the catch. Like, he trusts me to kind of complete it.
Mm.
But because he wanted to be the guy, and everybody he wanted the ball, he wanted to embrace the pressure and be the person to make a difference, he had nothing other but eyes on the ball. And unfortunately, He probably didn't realize I was right under the ball, and he wasn't stopping. I could see him coming, but like, and I focused on the ball. The ball came through the clouds and then through the lights, and I was under the ball. And then the last split second, I saw him still sprinting. He dove, he clipped me, and then the ball was dropped.
Yes. Man. You don't have...
So those are the three things.
Yeah. No. Well, I haven't heard you speak on that before, and it all makes sense. And yet, as you say, you try and block it out of your mind. I mean, you only have one more over to think about it. You know, you don't really have a lot of time to dwell.
Yeah.
But while Dale is bowling, is it hard not to think about it? I mean, or is that kind of all you can really think about?
I think you think about maybe the Villiers must run our chance. You think about Quinton de Kock must run our chance.
Yeah.
You think about some of those things. You think about a run here, maybe a fumble there. You think about all sorts of different things. You think that maybe you're not the only one. You think that maybe, I mean, I didn't play that semi-final. Yes, I had probably one of the biggest parts to play in a knockout tournament for our country. I don't know. I kind of tried to block it out. I didn't take it on board as much as what Mona and Dale had, because it was probably their last World Cups that they were going to go to.
Right.
From a 50-over point of view, I know Dale still managed to make it, but from that old school unit in 2015, I know AB felt it heavily because he was captain, and I never felt it as much because I never played as much.
What was it like in the dressing room after the Grant Elliott hits that six and it is one of the most unfortunately South Africa were on the losing end, but it was one of the most iconic World Cup moments in the history of the game. But not that you guys were thinking about that in the dressing room. I mean, what is the atmosphere like when you head back up the tunnel and into the dressing room?
Yeah, it's like a rugby change room. It's quite deep, quite far. It's a massive change room. So you're quite far from each other. Nothing. We just sat in the change room for about half an hour. New Zealand team came in. Well, we went to the New Zealand change room, actually. We congratulated them and wished them well in the final. And there's quite good blood between the New Zealand and the South African cricket teams. They're quite nice guys, and they see us as nice guys. So we get along with the guys quite nicely. And then the night we went back to the hotel, I don't think we just went to bed till like 6 in the morning because we just couldn't believe it. We couldn't sleep. We just chilled in one of the guys' rooms, and we listened to music. And I suppose nobody could sleep because if you close your eyes, the first thing you think about is the game. And so we wanted to stay awake and chat, and we ordered food, late night burgers and stuff, and until basically when you shut your eyes, you were basically so tired that you fell asleep, and we all woke up at like 2 in the afternoon, and we went, So I mean, that was basically how it all unfolded. There was the quiet, there was just some silence in the change room, and we kind of picked each other up a few days later, really.
Right. But I mean, you know, as you said, it's perhaps one of the things that you will be remembered for. But you played in the IPL. You went to Canada, played for the Edmonton Royals. I mean, which is quite amazing. I mean, that must have almost felt like a missionary, quest to go and take the religion of cricket to one of the far flung regions of the world.
Yeah.
You played in the Fanatic IPL. You captained your country. I mean, let's talk about captaining the country. What was that like? I mean, must have been an absolute dream come true.
Yeah, the dream come true. Captain of my country. I was at the Oval. The last time I played for our national side in the Champions Trophy in 2017. And on the wall, there's a captain's wall. So if you've captained your country, you can put your name on that particular wall. And that's just a little side note. But a lot of the players are resting. I know JP was resting. Kagiso, JP, Faf, Quinton de Kock. It was 5 players, and Hashim. They were all resting. So it started to blood a few younger guys. And at that time, I was probably one of the more senior guys in the team from a playing wise. And from an age perspective, I was obviously a bit older as well. And it was a momentous occasion. This young kid who grew up on the Cape Flats, grew up in Hillbrow, and then resided in the Cape Flats for the majority of his life, to now be captain in his country, one of the best 11 cricketers in that particular format on that particular day, was very special. And captain in that particular day was at SuperSport Park, my home ground, so that was also extra special. And we won. So, I mean, it was just a bit of a fairy tale start and a fairy tale day, really.
You speak about, born in Hillbrow, grew up in the Cape Flats, like a kid who could have only have dreamed of this. I mean, what you're touching on there is class and privilege and maybe even things like race. I mean, do you consider yourself socially or politically aware or active in any way? I mean, when you pull on the shirt, do you feel like you are representing something more than just a cricket team?
When I put on that national shirt, I was definitely representing more than just, I was representing my community where I grew up. I was representing my family. I was representing the hardships we went through as a family, as an immediate family, and as a greater part of my family, as a personal struggle from my, I had a very serious injury in 2005 when I was 21 years old, ACL, potential career threatening injury. The trouble, the strife, the hard yards, the club cricket, the amateur cricket, 6-7 years or 10 years of playing first class cricket to then captain your country, it's a long, goes back such a long way. And I definitely felt that there was a bit more, you know, for my parents, my dad, them, they got kicked out of their houses in District 6 when during the apartheid era.
Right.
My uncle got locked up because, you know, they got arrested for rioting and stuff. So, I mean, it was not rioting, like
protesting.
And, you know, stuff like that. My family got thrown to jail for those trying to fight for their rights as South African citizens. And so when I put on that shirt, I mean, especially that day to capture my country, I thought that was quite a proud moment.
We see in America athletes who use their platform to espouse social and political change, like Colin Kaepernick, for example, in the NFL, or, you know, LeBron James, or whoever it may be. Given that your family were kicked out of their homes and your uncle was arrested for protesting an evil apartheid regime, were you ever tempted, or have you ever been tempted to use your platform for protest or social activism?
You know what, I've been very fortunate that even though my parents went through that particular phase in their lives, they sheltered me from feeling it myself or being exposed to it. I grew up in Surrey State on the Cape Flats. It's the suburb next to Manenberg. Manenberg is one of the most notorious suburbs in the country with regards to drugs and crime. So, and even then, when I was staying at that particular residence for, I want to say, 5 till about 6, 7, to about 12 years, I stayed in that particular suburb, Surrey State, and it was so community orientated. We played cricket in the streets and soccer in the streets, and I never really felt it, so I never really knew what it was like. I was just a kid at the time, and all these things were happening. I was just happy to be to play some sport in the backyard with my little brother and with my friends in the street and my friends at school. And so, not that I'm not for social activism, and I'm not naive to think that, look, things are tough, but personally, I think there's a time and a place, and I would rather let my personal actions speak and the way I live try to speak more than actually saying something and posting and being very active in that particular space. I think, especially playing for South Africa and being involved with the Titans, I mean, you do have a persona and to have such strong political stances, just seemed like I would be fighting so many different battles other than trying to finish a game off where that's already in itself so tough.
Yeah.
So I decided, you know, to kind of stay away from that as best as I can, because I know deep down, my family knows deep down what I've been struggling for and what we've been fighting for, and, you know, to kind of do what I'm doing and for my family to be in a good place is kind of victory enough for us personally, but I know there are other people struggling much more out there, and but I think this, like, social media and all of that, just it's going to add so much pressure on me personally, because professional sport in itself is already so tough.
Yeah. No, I think that's well said, Faj. I think that's well said. You seem like such a chilled guy, both on and off the field. I mean, do you ever get riled up? A lot of people have opinions about you, journalists, fans on Twitter. Do those nasty comments ever get under your skin?
It's actually quite funny. I actually blocked Rob Arwing on Twitter once. I think he's still blocked. I don't even know. I haven't met the guy at all. I probably should unblock him. But to be honest, but like, I went through a phase in 2013, maybe David in 2012, went to Sri Lanka in 2013, played a bomb Sri Lanka side, Tilakrat and Dilshan, Kumar Sangakkara, Mahela Jayawardene, Ajanta Mendes, who was number one ODI bowler, or close to, in the world at the time.
Yeah, they were a great side.
A very fit young Lasith Malinga,
yeah.
I mean, I never played the first two games, I played the third game, got a duck. I got basically one duck 1-1 in my three innings, the third, the fourth, and the fifth ODI. Actually, in the third ODI, the only ODI we won, I got 3 for 19 in 7 overs. We actually won that game. So my bowling actually won us a game for my country, which was actually quite weird because I hardly bowled. But
a throwback to your varsity days.
Yeah, I thought that was quite a cool moment. I still brag about it till today. But I scored 2 runs in 3 innings, and I'd done by Jonathan Mendes twice, and in the last game I got 1 off like 15 balls. I couldn't hit the ball off the square. I felt like I was in no man's land, and Rob Owing was writing some things about me, and that's the emergence and the boom of like social media, I would imagine 7-8 years ago, where everything just took off, and I had and took a lot of things to heart because you wanted to know how good you were or how well you were performing. And I took it personally, and then I decided to not read anything in the paper, read anything in the news. About 6 months after that, it took a while. It scarred me for about 3 months after that tour.
Wow.
I was in such a bad place. It took me three months to get back to feeling myself again. But I made a conscious effort to not read into sports, read journalism, read the... You know as a player when you've done badly and when you've done well. So that's what I kind of hung on to.
It's interesting you say when you've done well, because I imagine reading the comments after you've done well can be just as dangerous as reading the comments after you've done badly, because the good comments could maybe then make you think that you're the next Don Bradman.
But that's what I decided not to read anything good or bad.
Yeah.
That was the one rule that I had, is that as much as I didn't want to read the bad things or just block that out, I can't only just read the good things, because I decided to entirely just wipe it off. Like, no, don't read anything unless it's like messages from my family or friends, and that's different. But like the news articles, and I decided about 3 months after that, is that probably the same people that will write badly about you is the same people that's going to write good news reports about you. So you could take them with a pinch of salt, and like I said, you basically know when you haven't batted well, or you might have taken the wrong decision today. You kind of know all of those things.
Yeah. Just finally, now, a lot of change has gone on in South African cricket over the last year. Mark Boucher, who of course you worked closely with at the Titans, is in charge. Graham Smith is at the helm, at director of cricket. Are you optimistic that a corner has been turned? I mean, you know more about domestic cricket than anyone in South Africa. I mean, if you could change something about the structure, the way things are run, you know, maybe an extra team or two, what would you do if you were in charge?
Man, I have the discussions all the time. I still sit on the players board. I've been on the players board for about 6-7 years now. And Saka, we
right.
actually, yeah. Now look, it's good for our cricket economy that, you know, there's some stability at the top. Dr. Jacques Full, Graham Smith, Mark Boucher. There's some like very strong individuals in those particular positions. We've been trying to devise a structure that's going to be a shake-up, that's going to be fruitful to South African cricket, that's going to provide, that is going to produce pro-tier players. It's all dependent on cash and surplus and how much income you have per year, per four-year cycle. Personally, I think you should have eight franchise teams. I think we need slightly more opportunities for professional cricket. But that also depends on, because we come from a system where there's 12, there used to be 12 provinces, and then you halve it into 6, and then each of the areas have 2, like Boland and Newlands, and Titans have Supersport Park and Willamore Park, Benoni. So, but to kind of have 8 professional teams, I mean, four of the teams are going to miss out, four of the stadium. So
right.
that then that becomes that becomes a political issue. Who do you give the other two franchise teams to? Do you give it to Border and to Boland? But then, like, Kimberley is going to be upset. Eastern's is going to be upset. Northwest is going to be upset. Like, it's such a balancing act. We've been trying to fight this particular story for the last... Since I started, we've been thinking about how we can streamline the structure, how we can make it financially viable. There will be some changes as a force change with regards to Cricket South Africa's financial position. So there'll be, I think, 10% less cricket next year. Instead of 10 four-day games, I think there'll be 8 four-day games. Instead of... double round T20 comp, there's one round T20 comp, but then there's two extra T20 teams. So, like, there's a few different things. I think my potentially offering a way back for the callback players to come and play is potentially maybe not for the whole season, maybe for different competitions. So if you're a stronger four-day player, you could sign a 5-game deal, or if you're a stronger white ball player, you could sign a 50-over deal or a T20 deal to kind of get those players back into the system. I think that might be a way to strengthen the game. Some people might argue that you're taking away opportunities from some of the younger guys to gain experience. But I'm definitely of the opinion that you need some senior players to lead. You need player-to-player learning. That's where the learning takes place. The coach can know everything, but like if you don't have your mate on the side of the field or while you're batting, in the heat of battle, kind of going through the scenarios and learning the game that way, the learning is going to take a bit slower in some cases, not in all cases. So player-to-player learning is quite massive in my opinion. So I would encourage them to have senior players come back into the system on some way, shape or form, allow the franchises to pay the players, the callback players coming back, because technically South Africa is their home, and I'm sure they would love to play for a couple of months of the year out of the off-season instead of just chilling or resting up, especially if you're young, you know, especially if you're young.
Yeah.
Some of those things, I mean, it's all linked to finances, and I suppose the next little bit's going to be tough because of the coronavirus and broadcast rights, and yeah, that's going to be a tough way to kind of navigate, a tough period to navigate exactly how you're going to do the structure.
Right. Well, yeah, as you say, it's going to be tricky. I mean, the whole world is impacted, and as much as cricket likes to pretend it exists in a bubble, it definitely doesn't. But Fudge, thank you so much. I really, we've been chatting for almost an hour and a half now. I so appreciate your time. And listen, you're a joy in domestic cricket in South Africa, and once normality resumes, we look forward to seeing you up in Durham, and hopefully we can link up for a beer when you get over here.
Cheers, man.
That's our show. Thanks for sticking around if you made it here. If you have, I'll take it that you enjoyed it, so please do share the love on social media. The more folks who listen, the more we're able to do. Big love again for Raider Media. You can find them and me on social media. And while you're there, why don't you give the show a follow on Twitter @short_fine_legs. Till next time.